From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we go to New York to the United Nations headquarters for the daily press conference with Stephan Dujarric, the spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
All right. Welcome to all of you, to all of everyone tuning in from even the non-continental United States in the upper reaches. I think you are, James, you are our first participant from Alaska. Welcome. All right. Good afternoon. I'll start off with a couple of notes on Mali and on the Sahel. First with Niger, where we strongly condemn Monday's attack that targeted and killed or injured dozens of civilians in the Tillaberi region of the country. We convey our deepest condolences to the families of the victims and to the people and government of Niger and wish a speedy recovery to those injured. And I expect a more formal statement from the Secretary General shortly. The head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel, Mohamed Mchambas, also issued a statement condemning the attack, and he urged the Nigerian authorities to take the necessary steps to ensure that those responsible for the despicable attack are arrested and brought to justice. Mr. Mchambas reiterated his solidarity with the people and government of Niger, as well as the continued support of the United Nations for the country and all of the countries in the region in their efforts to prevent and combat terrorism and violent extremism. And from Mali, the head of the UN mission there, Mohamed Anadif, expressed his deep condolences to the families and the victims, of the victims and the government of Mali following an attack on Malian forces near Gao. Many soldiers were injured and 33 were killed in an attack by unknown combatants. The UN peacekeeping mission there says they're evacuating the injured Malian soldiers to their hospital in Gao, and the UN mission continues to work with the authorities on what additional support it can provide. And moving on to the Central African Republic, following last Sunday's legislative elections, the UN mission in the Central African Republic reports that the vote counting, as well as the transfer of election results from polling stations to the regional branches of the National Electoral Authority, is underway. UN peacekeepers are providing security for the safe transportation of all the ballots, and that's, of course, in cooperation with the National Security Forces. Yesterday, electoral authorities began releasing provisional results over local radio. The results are released by polling stations, starting with Bangui, where 14 out of the 16 constituencies seats were being contested. Meanwhile, our humanitarian colleagues tell us that their partners have resumed assistance in Bria, in Haute-Kotto Prefecture and surrounding areas last week. Operations there were suspended at the end of February due to the risk of clashes between armed groups and national defense forces. There are over 73,000 displaced people in Bria. This is one of the country's largest concentration of displaced people. The overall humanitarian situation remains concerning. There are nearly 250,000 Central Africans displaced internally or as refugees in neighboring countries. Our humanitarian colleagues also tell us the number of attacks against humanitarian has spiked, particularly in the beginning of the year. Central African Republic is now one of the most dangerous places to work for a humanitarian worker. And a couple of days I want to flag, which are very important issues. In a video message to mark the International Day of Islamophobia, the Secretary General said that anti-Muslim bigotry is sadly in line with other disturbing trends we are seeing globally. That includes resurgence of ethno-nationalism, neo-Nazism, stigma, and hate speech that target vulnerable population, including Muslims, Jews, and some minority Christian communities, as well as others. Mr. Guterres notes that the Holy Quran reminds us that nations and tribes were created to know one another. Diversity is a richness and not a threat, he said in his message, adding that fighting discrimination, racism, xenophobia is a priority for the United Nations. That's why he said he launched the first ever of its kind UN strategy on hate speech, as well as a plan of action to safeguard religious sites. Also to be noted, on Monday will be the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And in a message that is being issued today, the Secretary General says that racism is deeply rooted global evil that transcends generations and contaminates societies. He adds that we see racism in the pervasive discrimination suffered by people of African descent, and we see it in the injustices and oppression endured by indigenous peoples and other ethnic minorities, and we see the repugnant views of white supremacists and other extremist groups. Wherever we see racism, he says, we must condemn it without reservation, without hesitation, and without qualification, and appeals to young people everywhere, as well as educators, leaders, to teach the world that all people are born equal. And I want to flag that today, in a press release, that the pre-summit gathering of the 2021 UN Food Systems Summit will take place in Rome from July 19th to 21st. Under the leadership of the Secretary General and the Prime Minister of Italy, Mario Draghi, the pre-summit event will bring together the efforts and contributions of global engagement processes to shape ambitions and transform food systems. The event will take place in a hybrid virtual format over 3 days. Many people will participate in person at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, while others from around the world will be engaged in a vast virtual platform. The UN Food Systems Summit will take place in September alongside the General Assembly here in New York. And on Myanmar, I want to flag that our team on the ground says they continue to be deeply disturbed by and concerned over the more than 2,000 people arbitrarily detained for their participation in a peaceful protest or political activity. The team is also condemning the use of force against children, with at least 15 having been killed. That's according to UN Children's Fund. And the International Organization for Migration says that migrants in Myanmar are among the most impacted by the current crisis. IOM says that an estimated 1 in 4 people in Myanmar are migrants. They're either internal migrants or international migrants. Violent crackdowns have occurred in areas hosting large numbers of internal migrants. IOM calls for an immediate cessation of violence, as well as the protection and recognition of the fundamental rights and aspiration of migrants and of all the people of Myanmar. They will continue to work and do their utmost to support the migrants in Myanmar, despite the difficult conditions. And on Yemen, I just want to flag that we, along with our humanitarian partners, released the 2021 Yemen Humanitarian Response Plan. The plan seeks $3.85 billion to provide urgent life-saving help to 16 million people. Some 20.7 Yemenis need some kind of humanitarian assistance, including 12.1 people in acute needs. As a reminder, just to give you some context, I think there are about 28 or 29 million people living in Yemen. Yemen continues to be the world's worst humanitarian crisis and the largest aid operation. Famine is stalking the nation, with more than half of the population facing acute food insecurity and record levels of acute malnutrition among children under 5. The last year's plan was only 56% funded, and as you will recall, it forced us to close some critical programs. We are doing everything we can to help, but we need adequate funding as needs continue to rise. At the high-level pledging conference that took place in early March, donors pledged only $1.7 billion for the response. That's less than half what is required. As he said, the Secretary General said, the pledges represent at best a down payment. We urge donors to quickly disperse their pledges and scale up funding for the humanitarian response to save lives. And if people have not yet pledged, it is never too late to do so. And a couple of good news COVAX stories. The state of Palestine today received the first batch of more than 60,000 doses of vaccines from the COVAX facility. The special coordinator for the Middle East peace process, Tor Wennesland, welcomed the arrival and encouraged all to get vaccinated. He said vaccines being sent to the West Bank and Gaza will be critical in the fight against the pandemic and for socioeconomic recovery. The UN team continues to support the government of Palestine in accessing vaccines through COVAX and also appreciates the Israeli coordination in facilitating these deliveries. And in Uzbekistan, our team there says the first batch of 660,000 doses of the vaccine arrived today via COVAX. It's about a third of the more than 2.2 million millions doses that Uzbek authorities are scheduled to receive in the coming months through COVAX. UNICEF has been supporting the national deployment as well as communications campaign to address people's hesitation towards the vaccine. For its part, WHO has helped train frontline health workers for the vaccination rollout. And finally, Fiji. The first phase of vaccination frontline health workers started last week with the arrival of 12,000 doses of the vaccine earlier this month. Fiji is the first country in the Pacific Islands to receive COVAX doses. WHO and UNICEF has helped the country prepare for the vaccine's arrival and its rollout, including supporting the much-needed cold chain for the distribution. And on staying on COVID, on Southeast Asia, a new report by the UN says that drastic cuts in essential public health services across the region due to the pandemic may have contributed to 228,000 additional child deaths in last year. Around 11,000 additional maternal deaths are also expected. Clinics and other facilities have been closed, and many vital nutrition programs halted as the region continues to battle to contain the virus. UNICEF says it is absolutely vital that these services be fully restored for children and mothers who are desperate in need of them, and that everything possible is to be done to ensure people feel free to use them. Tomorrow we have a guest. Our experts, they will be experts from the Food and Agriculture Organization, and we will be joined virtually by Maximo Torero, the FAO's chief economist, and Dominique Burgeon, the FAO's director of the Geneva office and director at interim of the Office of Emergencies and Resilience. They will be here to brief you on the latest report of the impact of natural disasters and crises in agriculture on food security. I will stop talking and I will start listening. Celia.
Stefan, I'd like to understand what is going on in Mali, because almost every week you're telling us that 10 people died or 5, or now it's 23. So my question is, what is the mission doing, and should the Security Council change the mandate?
Look, it is the violence that we're seeing is also due, I think, to the lack of political movement. And I think it is very important that those parties in Mali, and as you know, which is undergoing a transition, we know what happened last year, and we're working with the national partners and international partners to ensure a smooth transition. But it is very important that all political actors and some of the non-political armed actors reconvene and recommit, to the peace agreements and the accords that had been signed for the sake of the people of Mali. And as you see, the security situation is not going in the right direction. Edie, and then we'll go to Nabil.
Thank you, Steph. Group of eminent former and current human rights experts put out a report today looking back at the Secretary General's list over the past 10 years of countries that violated the rights of children in armed conflict. And they raised cases that they believe should have been on and either weren't or were taken off, including Saudi Arabia, Myanmar's military, Israel over its actions against Palestinian children, and others. I wonder what Can you tell us, please, what the Secretary General's reaction is?
Sure. First of all, I have to say we appreciate the views expressed. We have worked really since the start of the mandate. The office has worked diligently with many partners, including NGOs, and everyone is working towards the same goal: improving the protection of children and wiping out the scourge of children being forced as combatants and, of course, as victims of conflict. The Secretary General's report is one critical tool that is meant to generate action. I think year after year, the report and the associated work of all our colleagues on the ground and in New York to change behaviors in the most difficult circumstances. Our goal is to end and prevent grave violations against children. Each year, we report on progress and setbacks. There's a lot of focus on the list, per se, but I think it's also critical to read the full narrative in the reports every year, which lays out in detail how children are impacted by the conflict and the work is being done to better protect boys and girls, notably through plans of action. And I think we have seen over the years improvements in some areas with plans of actions being signed by different combatants. There's always going to be discussion among people of the conclusions of the report, the methodology, the observations, the recommendations. We stand by them, and we're always happy to engage with relevant partners in how to improve the system. Okay, Nabil, and then we'll go to the screen.
Thank you, Steph. I'm sure you've seen the latest report on Libya, the panel of experts, and it's actually shocking how much details we can read in the report. Member states, names of people, companies, a long list of violators to the arms embargo on Libya. So can you share with us what's the SG's reaction on these facts? How does he think that the arms embargo can be implemented more effectively on Libya?
You talk about the arms embargo and the issue of mercenaries and foreign fighters. The sanctions imposed, the sanctions imposed by the Security Council are very clear. The Secretary General has called out repeatedly for them to be enforced. How do they better enforced? Member states need to obey and follow what the Security Council has decided. It's very clear. It's a matter of people, of member states and others living up to the conditions and the commitments put forward by the Security Council.
And another question on Lebanon. It seems that the country is running out of cash and demonstrators are back in the streets. Do you have a message to the political leaders in the country, especially that they have failed until now in reaching an agreement and forming a new government?
Listen, we continue to look at the situation in Lebanon with concern. The message from the United Nations to the Lebanese leadership is pretty clear. They need to form a government without delay that responds to the very legitimate needs and calls that we've been hearing from the people on the streets, and to undertake the structural reforms to address the worsening socioeconomic situation. Okay, Richard Roth.
Hello there, Mr. Spokesman. Can you hear me?
I can hear you and I can see you. I can see you in the shadows. I'm not 100% sure it's you, but I do recognize your voice, Richard. Go ahead.
Your audio went down beside of me. I see Mr. Bays is on the line. I don't know if he's in Alaska, but let me ask a question or a follow-up on what he's been asking about. Can you tell us anything new on the Afghanistan process? Has the UN formally been approached to, quote, host it, or is this a Turkish affair? I'm asking for a friend who's not part of the talks.
Okay. We continue to be in discussions with key players, whether in no particular order, the United States, the Russian Federation, the Qataris, the Turks. Our aim is to best support the people in Afghanistan in reaching peace. And in ensuring that the gains that have been obtained over the last years, especially on the rights of women, are not lost in any political discussion. But I don't have any firm dates or meetings to announce for you as of yet. Okay, Iftikhar.
Thank you, Steph. My question was asked by Richard Roth just now, but I want to ask you, will you be releasing the text of the message of the Secretary General that you read out about Islamophobia? Because I don't see it on the line.
Okay, we will make sure. I think it was released. We will send it out again if it wasn't, but it will be posted, and as well as the video message on the elimination of racism.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Wave your hands if you have something. Yes, Ibtisam and James, yes.
Hi, Steph. I have first a follow-up on Edith's question regarding the Secretary General report and the list. As a matter of fact, the things that Edith mentioned, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Myanmar, etc., this critic was already said before, and we saw, as a matter of fact, that the situation actually became worse in the last few years, and still he is insisting not to put these countries on the list. The list is important because it does put countries under pressure. So you saying, you should look also into the details. Yes, it's important, but his list undermines somehow what is being reported in the reports themselves.
Yeah, I'll respectfully disagree with you in your analysis. I think the narrative goes into great detail. The list is also very important, and it's a tool. And you know, as I said, we are always open to a dialogue with NGOs, and we've been in fact involved in a dialogue with the NGO that briefed you earlier. But we stand by the report and the methodology, which I think speak for themselves. And we will report again in June of this year on what's happened in the previous year.
Okay, I have another question on the issue of United Kingdom and the increase of their nuclear weapon arsenal. Do you have a comment on it?
Yes, in addition to what I said yesterday, we welcome the UK's reaffirmation in the Integrated Review of Security, Defence and Foreign Policy of its commitment to a world without nuclear weapons, to disarmament, arms control, and the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. But we do express our concern at the UK's decision to increase its nuclear weapons arsenal, which is contrary to its obligations under Article 6 of the NPT and could have a damaging impact on global stability and efforts to pursue a world free of nuclear weapons. At a time when nuclear weapon risks are higher than they have been since the Cold War, investments in disarmament and arms control is the best way to strengthen the stability and reduce nuclear danger.
I have a follow-up. Do you believe that such a decision will have a negative impact on the negotiation regarding the Iran issue and the Iran deal? And what this would do to the credibility at all of such negotiations?
Look, I think that's a question best left to analysts and journalists to try to predict what will happen. We've expressed our concern of the UK decision. We also very much hope that all the parties to the JCPOA will redouble their efforts to, in a sense, revive what was a very important diplomatic agreement.
Thank you.
Mr. Bays, welcome.
Hello there. I have I have two follow-ups, and then I have a question. Let's do the follow-ups one by one. On Afghanistan, you mentioned the various diplomacy going on around the world. The first piece of that is the Russia talks. Who is participating on behalf of the United Nations?
I need to get back to you on that because I was trying to get confirmed and I was not able to. But we'll send out a note as soon as we know.
Okay. On Nabil's question about Libya and the panel of experts report, you said it was the obligation now of member states. So can I just test that a bit further? For example, the founder of Blackwater, Eric Prince, is named for his role in breaching sanctions. Does the UN believe it's the responsibility of the US Department of Justice now to investigate this, find out whether he breached sanctions, and if he did, to bring him to court?
The conclusions of the panel, which, as you know, is independent and reports straight to the Security Council, not to the Secretary General. It's the work of panel of experts are very important. As a follow-up, it's the job of the relevant Libyan authorities, including judicial and other branches, as well as any other member state concerned, to decide on any follow-up. I mean, the information presented by the panel is transparent. It's 500 pages, and we hope that every member state goes through it, reads it, and takes the appropriate action.
And one new question, if I can. Sudan's Prime Minister Hamdok has written to the UN, to the AU, to the European Union and the United States now to formally request mediation in terms of the dispute that Sudan has with Ethiopia over the Gerd Dam. Does the UN have any response to that? Is the UN going to actively mediate now?
Confirmed that we did indeed receive the letter from Prime Minister Hamdok. We are my response to you, and of course we will respond to him as well, is that we reiterate our readiness to support all efforts towards reaching an agreement of the on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Mr. Guterres welcomes initiatives to move the negotiations forward and awaits agreement from all the parties as to how the UN can best support the process. Go ahead, Nabil, and then I have a statement on Niger I want to read out.
So can you please clarify what do you mean by the last statement on Sudan? Because we know that there is a track with the African Union, there is the quartet group, and there is
To put it in plainer English, as always, all the parties involved in any dispute, any conflict, all need to agree together on mediation, support, negotiation. So we're basically we're waiting for an agreement from all the parties on how we can best support the process.
So one more follow-up. So you mean the parties should decide themselves, or does the SGE doing something to convince
them? We're continuing discussions, you know, and the AU is as well. But, I mean, basically, if you and I have a dispute and we want Edie to mediate, we both have to agree that she is willing to mediate, which I'm sure she would be, as a matter of principle.
I hope so.
Yes. Though we will never come to that, Nabil. Okay. I want to read out a statement on the attack in Niger, which I alluded to earlier. The Secretary General strongly condemns the attack on March 15th by unidentified gunmen in Banibangu in the Tillaberi region of Niger. He expresses his deep condolences to the bereaved family and wishes a swift recovery to those injured. He urges the Nigerian authorities to spare no effort in bringing the perpetrators to justice. The Secretary General reiterates the commitment of the UN to continue supporting Niger in its efforts to counter and prevent terrorism and violent extremism, promote social cohesion, and achieve sustainable development. Okay, any other questions? Excellent.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.